So the idea is that I just will ask one question to our panel, and you have the time to think of your questions. So we would like to have you as participants in this debate as quickly as possible. First of all, I would like to thank the three of you for really wonderful presentations, which are covering quite a space. For me, to some extent, the challenge is what is, so to say, the core from which one can open up the three perspectives and bring them together at the same time. I think what was very clear, the way you addressed the topic of justice, was that both all the three of you were basically criticizing a kind of universalist concept of justice, which is quite often also misused in political colonial strategies. So what you shifted all to some extent, is to deal with injustices in different ways. Mm-hmm. And there, to some extent, what Nikita said at the end, I think, is the real question behind all the three discussions are what institutions, what kind of framings we have to deal with these injustices, which, as we saw, for example, also in Sarah's presentation, are inbuilt in technological infrastructures and are inbuilt in a world order where different kind of time scales, different kind of power logics are so intertwined that the same argument may fit in one context, but may be exactly the opposite in another context. Mm-hmm. So where is the level of institutional or community interventions in this kind of complexities to deal with them? Mm-hmm. It's a question to all the three of you. Because what I also find very interesting in your context, if you look, let's say, from a state solution for the problem, is the way you put it is, as I understood it, is basically you have socially to fight. Just you have to fight the social injustice warrior. There is no other way. I mean, there is no way of argumenting with them or dealing with them in a kind of rational way. Is that the solution, or?
What I find interesting is, first of all, I think when we look at Sarah's presentation, I think obviously the way we deal with these things is more about subversion, perhaps. There's something than about, you know, a grand scheme.
I don't know.
It seemed to me.
I think partially. I mean, there's multiple entry points. Obviously, none of us are going to be able to take we couldn't barely take on the term. Mm-hmm. But that, to me, the technological isn't necessarily like a fighting mechanism. It's a condition for this possibility, right? So the technological, at least this is my contribution to this discussion, would have to be one of those institutions. It has to be elevated culturally. It has to be recognized as a field of social possibility, not just some mm-hmm. tool or addendum or something. Mm-hmm. So it would be for that to be included within the conversation. But I don't think that's the...
By whom? By the state? By communities?
It's unavoidable. Yeah. So basically everyone. Yeah.
But the register of the conversation has to change from this sort of mm-hmm. media space, this tool-based notion of I pick up something and I'm using it to... And it's also pre-digital. It's not just about digital culture. This is... That's the other thing. It's not just a current phenomena that certain technological landscapes give rise to particular types of social characters, but this is the one we're contending with now.
Mm. I think mine is a much more modest effort. I think I'm just trying to address the question of how in trying to do justice, and in trying to demand justice and make claims of justice, how subalternity is produced. Although one is trying to desubalternize. Mm. And I hope that came across with the two examples, whether it was the Delhi gang rape or what happened in Germany. Mm. So there are those who say that the state no longer is a legitimate addressee of claims to justice because the state has somehow forfeited its accountability towards its citizens. We don't turn to the state anymore. And we look in non-state spheres of how to achieve justice, yeah, because we can't rely on the state anymore.
And there are a lot of people who do not belong to states.
I mean, I always say this, some of the most important interlocutors for me, and that's the great thing about teaching, you learn a lot from your students, were my anarchist students in Frankfurt, who, of course, because of a very, very difficult history in Germany, are very, very suspicious about the state because of the state monopoly on violence. And I would always tell my anarchist students, it's great that you critique the German state, but you can critique the German state because you have papers. And here we have to take very seriously what Hannah Arendt tells us, that there's nothing sacred about being stateless. So she's saying it's wonderful to have the Universal Declaration of Rights, but there is no guarantee of these Universal Declaration of Rights because there is no world state. And being a good Kantian, she does not want a world state. So what does it mean not to belong to a political community?
So,
and how in this claim, sorry, I'll wrap it up, but this claim that we all belong to either this global political community or there are, you know, subaltern counter-public spheres. I hope the critique, it was not just a critique of Butler also, but also a critique of Fraser. That there are these subaltern counter-publics that emerge. And my point is actually the idea of subaltern counter-publics is an oxymoron. Because if you take Gramsci seriously, the very idea of subalternity is, and I'm reading Gramsci via Spivak, is neither having access to the state nor civil society or public sphere. And that's for me the most, key question. How do struggles for justice, how do processes of justice, how do practices of justice produce subalternity?
Just to add on to that, I think this is a really important point because if we, one of the things we didn't all get to talk about, but it's there, is that there are communities of care and justice within these sort of counter movements as well, right? But we don't map all of them or consider them. They're all deeply suspect of the state. And I think that there are things going on that provide a model for... provide a model to the question that you actually asked. It's just this trust in the institution. Nobody should be expected to trust the state.
But how would you deal with this phenomenon that consumption desires, let's say, in Europe, are producing working conditions in China as we saw them? Where is the state? Which state you are addressing them to?
Well, here there's, of course, the direct critique of post-colonial states. There is also this disillusionment. I mean, the whole anti-colonial struggles were fought in the belief that we will be able to govern ourselves. They will be able to throw out the colonizers, and we will... I mean, what does Fanon tell us? Leave this Europe, where they're constantly talking about men and murdering men everywhere. We will not mimic Europe. We will chart our own path. And that was the promise and the aspiration of the emergence of post-colonial states. We'll have sovereignty, we'll have self-governance and self-determination. And this is where I think the promise of Bandung and the non-aligned movement turned to disillusionment, because now the post-colonial state in a certain way is protecting protecting the rights of the capitalist class than its own subalternized citizens. And this is where I say that we have to, in a certain way, re-envision and reimagine our relationship to the state. I, of course, come from a very elite class in the post-colonial context. However, if one is interested and sees a connection between decolonization and desubalternization, then we have to reimagine the state so that it can be made accountable to its vulnerable citizens, and not just citizens like me. And here, particularly talking about the post-colonial state.
Yeah. What I find interesting about that is that, in a way, this demands for a whole structural change of how we think political theory. And I think it's interesting that we now rereading Gramsci, you know, after, you know, basically 30 years or 40 years, he was quite forgotten. Then he got up in the 90s, but between the his death and before, there was nothing. And that's because, in a way, the way we do political theater today is much more, well, it's much more strategic, it's less conceptual, it's more, you know, piecemeal in a way, and much more reminds on, you know, in a way, early modern Prince's Mirrors written for the democratic public, in which we somehow look at how, in which we somehow have to learn to analyze political situation in a very specific and concrete manner and draw our conclusions out of it, while we don't really can do a lot with grand-style political theory. Maybe we can draw some principle out of it that motivate us, but this is, in a way, only the beginning of what we need for relevant political theory.
I mean, Ramchi was only forgotten here. He was not never forgotten. The whole subaltern studies, historians, and...
When? In the 70s, in the 60s?
Sure. This is the emergence of the South Asian Subaltern Studies Group, where...
Okay, I think
that's good.
We open up now. Yeah. We have mics on both sides, so whatever you would like to... here.
Hello, I have a question for Sarah and one for Nikita as well. I would like to talk about privilege and the moment of exhaustion or the possibility to step out that you mentioned. And what about these communities, so queer communities, communities of color, etc., who cannot afford to step out? Are these, following your line of argument, then the communities that are more likely and quicker to build the meaningfully coalition of broken machines that we need in order to fight our social injustice warrior? And one question to Nikita. I would like you to reflect on philanthropists and their role and how they can influence our work of justice, so to say.
Yeah, this is a really good question. When I think of that sort of self-care example, sort of a Trump was elected, I'm exhausted one, I think of, it's the reigning sort of discourse of neoliberal feminism right now. And it's precisely what you say. So I'd say, yes, I think those are the right examples. But also, you know, self-care was a term, is a term that's been co-opted. Like it's a black radical feminist term that's co-opted by neoliberal feminism. And the difference being that, like, in the context of black radical feminism or queer communities, the care, the sort of self-care is always oriented to the community. It's like you exit out of the situation in order to enter back into a community of care. It's also, it's about maintenance and sustenance of that community. It's not like a digital noteworthy shot of yourself getting a manicure or something like that. It's not actually, you can't really document that type of self-care in the same way. So I think exactly that. It's that idea of sustenance and care, but it's about a collective. It's not about just the self in a larger political sphere and being exhausted.
I'm going to give you a slightly longish answer, if I may. Please indulge me. I'll tell you a story, and this actually happened. And this is a story I heard from a dear friend of mine who works in a grassroots NGO. And this is in south of India. Where the village where she was working, again, Dalit women, so untouchable women, were not allowed to access water from the village well. Now, India has one of the most progressive constitutions in the world. And just like you're not allowed to discriminate against anybody in Germany on the basis of their skin color, and yet there is racism in Germany, you're not allowed to discriminate against anybody on the basis of their caste, and yet there's casteism in India. So she was working in this context, and then she was contacted by an international NGO which was working in the field of women's human rights and millennial development goals, and said, look, we have some funds, and is there some project that you would want us to support? So she reported about this case of, you know, how women had to walk a couple of hours every day to get water because they were not allowed to get water from the village well because the upper caste would not allow them to get water because they were considered contaminated. So then the international funding body sent a representative to do a little bit of a survey of what the context was to approve the funding. And the philanthropist, the do-gooder, the well-wisher came there to survey the context and said, okay, I mean, these women have to work for a couple of hours, so she released funds to build a pump so that women could access water. Now, when I first heard this story, I said, well, great, fantastic. I think, and here I'm being self-critical, I think I would have done the same thing. It's common sense. Women can't access water, so she organized access to water. After 6-9 months, this international NGO person came back to check out what's happening, and I presume she was hoping to get a note of thanks from these women, and then realized that the women were still walking a couple of hours every day to fetch water. And she was a bit upset, and predictably so. So then she kind of got a translator to talk to these women. To find out, so she immediately, her concern was, are these women being bullied by perhaps the upper castes? Are they being intimidated? And then she got a translator to talk to these women and said, what's going on? You know, isn't the pump working? Trump working.
She said Trump. Yeah.
Paging Freud. Isn't the pump working? And first the women were not really willing to talk to her, but then, you know, she kind of built trust with the women, and after a few days, the women told her, well, you know, the thing is that this is the only social time that we get away from our village elders. Ah. Where we can talk about our problems with each other and, you know, sing together and are also somehow relieved of taking care of our children because my mother-in-law takes care of the children or my father-in-law takes care. So this is our social time. So, of course, it's inconvenient to go and fetch water. You know, we have to walk for a couple of hours. So if there's an emergency, of course, we use the pump, but we actually then tell our village elders the quality of water 2 hours away is better than from the pump. And this is a little bit of a problem of trying to do good. Good intentions. I mean, we should not forget. I teach Introduction to Postcolonial Studies in Germany. I've been teaching it for the past 15 years, and I again and again and again tell my students, when you go out of this class, please remember one thing. Colonialism was not done by bad guys. It was undertaken by people who had good intentions. Missio civilisatris. Those are the only two words I know in French, so let me... But good intentions don't always translate into good consequences. And I think if we are talking about global solidarity, politics of justice, of help, of transnational alliances, we need another ethics of listening.
And I'd add that this was a technological solution, right? The water pump. But there was already a set of rhythm of relations in there, and then it set off a new... I'm not just pushing the technological anytime I can,
sure.
But
sure.
I have a second, so... But yeah, it's also that idea of the technological being free and clear, a good thing to add on into communities that in and of itself would be saving. So.
I think if we go on like this with stories, there are two more questions possible. No, are there more questions?
I come from a land of Bollywood.
No,
I can't respond with a drama.
Okay, no, but are there more questions? Yeah, here, in the center.
Thank you very much. I didn't have much to write on during the discussion, so I didn't prepare any very specific question for you. But one point that Nikita mentioned in her presentation that really caught my interest was the role of empathy when it comes to normative action or when it comes to justice. I don't think you ended up speaking all that much about it, but I was quite curious about it and was going to ask whether you can say some more words about it.
I'll give you a very short answer because I'm still thinking about it. I use the English word empathy and I also use compassion, but I actually like the German word Mitleid because it has... I know, non-German speakers in the audience, so I'm going to try and translate it. Leiden is to suffer and Mitleiden is to suffer with. And it's actually an interesting word because no matter how much we empathize with others, There is, of course, the question of embodiment. So that Mitleiden has its limits, and yet, I think it's a beautiful German word, and I'm very happy for this reason that I did learn the German language, because there are certain words that are untranslatable. But I'm still thinking through that. And how this whole, this is a very important affect turn in queer politics, in postcolonial theory, in the humanities, how political emotions can play a role in ethics. Mm. So that would be kind of my response to... there is another very nice German word, which would be the opposite of Mitleiden, which is Schadenfreude, where you actually take pleasure in other people's pain, in suffering, where you say, look, I'm so lucky that I'm not suffering like them. Mm-hmm. So I would think these two terms together, Mitleiden and Schadenfreude. And there is a lot of Schadenfreude.
There's a perverse twist in that in German, I think, because you can say compassion is something nice, and compassionate is something, is the adjective to it. In Germany, Mitleid is okay, but Mitleidig is actually extremely condescending. So Mitleidig, and I think there's something, and there is, I think the way we use it's always some caveat to say when you apply Mitleid, you might leave the... Well, you might leave something like equality. So there's something top-down about Mitleid, I think, in the German. And that's interesting because there's a problem with empathy, obviously, too, mm-hmm. As a measure or as a reason for action in general.
I mean, I have to look this up.
Yeah.
But I'm just coming from Gießen, where I gave a keynote. Let me. Improve my impact factor. And then somebody told me that actually there's a very nice connection, the etymology of the word Mitleid mm-hmm. and the whole question of ethics also. I have to look this up. A lot of my leftist friends prefer solidarity to Mitleid because, you know, Mitleid has a little Christian kind of this to it. But I have to do my research here. So thank you for your question, and I hope I'll come back with a better answer the next time we meet.
But I think Sarah's point with the mother's basement, the person in mother's basement would not have Mitleid.
So that is now the...
He could develop solidarity, but he would not have Mitleid.
With?
With another person.
With another white male... victim?
No, not even Mitleid.
It's
just self-centered.
I was going to say the only word, German word I hear on a regular basis in Canada is Schadenfreude. So
Schadenfreude,
it's the only one.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there are a lot of the people that Sarah was talking about who have a lot of Mitleid with Trump.
Mitleid with Trump.
Yeah, because they're saying he's constantly saying I'm being witch hunted by the fake press. Nobody has been treated as badly as he's constantly victimizing himself.
And only somebody can get what kind of person and can so get witch hunted by a fake press.
Yeah,
to
so
begin
I think
with,
there so. Is a lot of sympathy for him there also. So Mitleid can be this can be turned this way or that way. I think that's the thing with political emotions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, one last question. Oh, over there.
Oh. Thank you for your presentations. I'm a student of the Latin American Institute, and I would be very curious why you think that the state is less co-opted or by the market, or because I mean, of course, civil society is linked to the state by the market, but the state is the same way part of the big game, I would say. So
absolutely.
I would like to hear your...
Okay, so maybe I was not precise enough, and thank you for giving me the opportunity of clarifying that. What I was trying to show was that there is this juxtapositioning that has been introduced actually by Hegel, where... we have the stereotype of the good civil society versus the bad state. And what I was trying to show is, using Gramsci is that the civil society is not outside and opposite the state, but rather is linked to the state through the market and is part of the, so the state has, that's why that image in the Pepsi ad is so good. There is the coercive state apparatus, yeah, zwang, and then the civil society where consensus is produced. And zwang und consens, that go together. And of course, you're absolutely right, the state is as much linked to the market as civil society is. In fact, this was the first response that I gave, that the state, particularly the post-colonial state, is protecting the market, the capitalist interests. And that's where we need to reconfigure the state, where the state becomes accountable to its vulnerable citizens. Does that clarify your...
Yes, but is this... But this can happen in alliance with the civil, I mean, it can only happen with alliance with the civil society, or is it?
What can happen in alliance?
That the state can play a more effective role in protecting those who are really vulnerable within the state.
I will give you a Spivakian answer to this, whereby she would say that this can happen, the reconfiguration of the state can happen when subaltern groups get access to the state. And this is a Gramscian Spivakian answer, where de-subalternization happens when subalterns get access, become the state.
And is this happening without the civil society?
Gramsci would argue that civil society functions as impediment for subalterns to become state because civil society functions as a, you know, take a pressure cooker metaphor, and civil society functions as a release without transformation. So this is the idea of passive revolution, where there is transformation, where there is change without transformation. And that's the function of civil society. So civil society for Gramsci is neither a negative nor a positive concept. I'm not saying you bypass civil society, but I'm also saying what I'm pointing out is you don't bypass the state.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you very much from my side. Thank you very much to the audience for the questions, but also thank you very much for the wonderful presentations tonight. And good night.